The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Hello everyone, this is a special episode of the History of the World podcast on a subject commissioned by History of the World podcast Illuminati member Shane Smith. And he has asked that we speak this week on the Icelandic saga writer called Snorri Sturluson. The story of Snorri Sturluson is also the story of how Iceland lost its independence. It is also a study of the modernisation of medieval Nordic kingdoms in the aftermath of the Viking Age. Snorri Sturluson was an inspirational man for many people of his time and after his lifetime. In this episode, we cover the biographical story of Snorri Sturluson and find out what the legacy of his lifetime means to us today. Firstly, though, we need to look at the unique and mysterious island of Iceland and where it fits into European politics. Iceland is an island in the northern Atlantic Ocean, somewhat remote and largely uninhabitable due to the fact that it was formed through volcanic activity. During the very first episode of the History of the World podcast, we told the story of how we believe that the dinosaurs were removed as the dominant animals of the Earth by an asteroid impact that occurred around 66 million years ago, and how primates evolved to become great apes, among other things, and in turn, human beings. While primates were making this evolutionary journey, volcanic activity in the northern Atlantic Ocean brought the island of Iceland up from underneath the surface of the ocean, bringing a new island onto the surface of the earth. The Nordic peoples of the turn of the second millennium have been immortalized in European culture and folklore as the beloved and terrifying Vikings, whose influence spread far and wide from their heartlands in Scandinavia to the many lands and territories across the expansive waters that they traversed with great skill. Inevitably, the island of Iceland was within these waters, and the Vikings explored with interest. Being a Viking was being of a culture as opposed to being of a national identity. Vikings may just as readily pillage and plunder from each other than from others. So the Vikings that landed on Iceland may just have easily have come from the Viking settlements of the British Isles, as well as those of modern-day Norwegian lands. Some historians even believe that Irish monks were among the first settlers of Iceland, perhaps as early as the 8th century. The Vikings that settled Iceland were unlikely to have been sent by a central government. It appears more likely that there was a more tribal style to Viking behaviour, and so the Vikings in Iceland would have answered to no central authority, but to whoever was leading their individual tribe. The cold climate there would lead to the island receiving the name Iceland from very early on, and the settlement would have been initially very limited. Migrations came in waves from the late 9th century onwards from Vikings travelling from Scandinavia, the British Isles, and other island groups of the North Atlantic, such as the Faroes and the Shetlands. The settlers of Iceland lived quite independently from other lands overseas and deemed it sensible to protect their own common interests. And so they formed an Icelandic Commonwealth. Survival on Iceland may have required cooperation between tribes due to there being limited land fertility. Population expansion would not have been possible as a consequence and may never have exceeded 50,000 individuals before the 12th century. Many societies relied on marine hunting to support their diet. With settlers firmly established in Iceland who considered themselves to be Icelanders, there was very little value in anybody attempting an invasion. Iceland was remote and didn't have much to offer to the invader, other than a fierce battle and a mainly barren volcanic rock landscape. It would be natural that population expansion brought about local disputes about land ownership, so there was an increase in urgency for the requirement of some form of legislation within the Commonwealth. The year 930 is a very important milestone in Icelandic history for the reason that a parliamentary assembly called the Althing was formed. And the remarkable thing about this assembly is that it still exists to this day as the parliament of the modern country of Iceland. Therefore, it has a legitimate claim to being the world's oldest parliament still in existence. The most prominent role within the Althing was that of the law speaker, although it must be stated that the law speaker, despite being a very important and honourable position, didn't give the individual much in the way of power. With that still remaining with the numerous chieftains, with the law speaker acting much more like an arbitrator than a president. One aspect of the Vikings which has captured public imagination are the Viking sagas, which were fantastic oral tales combining historical fact with mythological storytelling. And Iceland was the origin of a large number of sagas, all relating to the earliest centuries of Icelandic habitation. But like many other of the world's oral traditions, challenging the reader to decipher the truth from fantasy. Despite this, the Icelandic sagas are still a very important source when looking for details regarding Icelandic history, as well as the history of other lands of the North Atlantic.
Early life.
So let us focus on what type of environment that Snorri was born into, and a bit about his family background. Entering into the 12th century and the chieftains of Iceland were enjoying the wealth of their island without an overruling royal family or emperor taking all the wealth for themselves. However, this would create a scenario where some of the wealthier families would begin to become more powerful by taking control of weaker chieftains with nowhere else to turn. One of these families were the Sturlunga family clan, whose role in Icelandic history during this period was highly important. The Sturlunga family were descended from a man called Sturla, who was the chieftain of a small town called Hamarindalit. Sturla married a woman called Gudni, and they would have three sons. Their names were Thordur, Sigvatur and Snorri. The three sons would take the name Sturluson to denote that they were the sons of Sturla, which was the traditional means of acquiring your second name in Iceland during this time. Snorri was the youngest of the three full brothers, the sons of Sturla and Gudni. He was born in the year 1179. It appears that Snorri had an excellent education provided by another powerful Icelandic chieftain called Jon Lofsson, who was also the grandson of King Magnus III of Norway, also known as Magnus Barefoot, and he was also a member of the Odaverja family clan. Jon's chieftain was centred at a place called Oddi, which may have been well known among the Icelanders as a place of academia. There is a legendary story about how Snorri received the opportunity to get this education, especially when you consider that Jon Lofsson belonged to a different, and some might suggest, a rival family. Snorri's father, Sturla, was trying to settle a legal dispute with a chieftain priest. The priest's wife attacked Sturla with a knife and injured his face. To prevent a punishment from the Althing, Jon Lofsson stepped in to prevent further repercussions for the priest and his life by offering to take Snorri into his educational establishment. So Snorri would reach adulthood with the benefit of what is likely to have been the best education on offer in Iceland, that may not have been a centre for religion such as a monastery. Snorri was around 20 years of age when he was married to the daughter of a chieftain. Her name was Herdis. Herdis came with the wealth from her father's estate at a farmstead called Borg and its surrounding territory, which Snorri took control of, before seeking to expand on his influence. By all accounts, it does seem that Snorri cared very little for Herdis, taking advantage of the wealth of the marriage and consigning her to a life of pregnancy and motherhood, while Snorri himself looked to capitalise on his wealth and apparently enjoy carnal delights with ladies away from his marital home in Borg. Snorri's marriage broke down after just a few years, but by this time Snorri had acquired lands and money that made him one of the more important chieftains of Iceland. Iceland, once a peaceful commonwealth of societies, was now taking the often natural route of developing into a hotbed of wealth and competitiveness, where the weaker societies were being absorbed by more powerful societies, and the competition for resources and influence would escalate to the inevitability of conflict. Iceland was certainly beginning to head in that direction. Snorri appears to have abandoned his marriage by the year 1206, when he moved to a new settlement at Reykholt, and we can actually see some of the work that may have been overseen by Snorri at Reykholt to this very day, with some remains of his farm and house at the modern tiny village of Reykholt. We can see his outdoor bathhouse, which is linked by a tunnel to the farm. Visitors can go to Reykholt, where it is now a medieval research centre. One thing that didn't change while Snorri was at Reykholt was his appetite for women, and he would father children by multiple women during his time there. It does seem as though Snorri was producing poetry at Reykholt, and so he was gaining national interest on a number of levels. He was a capable estate manager with political influence thanks to his birth, and was now reaching out to the people by immortalising poetry and storytelling that would capture the public's imagination.
Political career.
So now we know of Snorri's earliest years, we can now explore how he became a man of international reputation. Snorri was a hard-working and dedicated man. His academic ability, coupled with his desire to be successful at whatever he applied himself to, would undoubtedly be the thing that led him to become a notable individual in Icelandic history. However, there was a strong element of work hard, play hard to Snorri. He wasn't known to be a particularly athletic man, and he had very little interest in military engagements, preferring to gather his wealth by diplomacy and clever marriage alliances made for his growing number of children. He was probably quite a charming character, with a strong ability to memorise important information such as legal knowledge. As well as enjoying the company of different women, he would also enjoy relaxing and drinking. He was known to be a heavy drinker and an overweight man. Snorri's legal knowledge, which he would have gained from his education, would undoubtedly have enabled him to win the influence over other chiefdoms and make him one of the wealthier men of Iceland, and also one of the more influential men of the island. It would be in the year 1215 that he would be given the opportunity to become the law speaker in the Althing, which was a reflection of his general popularity. His poetry was sought after, and he could equally charm important individuals through the sale of his poetic talent as much as he could influence them with his legal knowledge. As mentioned before, the position of the law speaker in the Althing may not have been a heavily influential role, and it might be for this reason that we don't really have any information about anything that happened during Snorri's first period as the law speaker. Now, we need to switch our focus overseas and to the troubled lands of Norway that had been embroiled in civil war for many decades. During the early 12th century, the Gille dynasty from Ireland had effectively usurped the throne from the traditional Hardrada dynasty. However, the Gille dynasty suffered from a succession crisis, allowing a member of the House of Hardrada to be brought back to the throne during the 1160s. In the 1180s, a new faction arrived from the Faroe Islands and deposed the king once more, thus starting the Sverre dynasty. The Sverre dynasty is significant to our story. The Sverre dynasty's usurpation, which they would claim to be legitimate, was opposed by the Catholic Church, who supported the Hardradas. And this would cause a political split in Norway, which would frequently descend into battle. The aristocrats were denied influence over the Norwegian monarchy, which was overseen by a populist movement against the aristocracy. The populist movement, which were called the Birkebeiners, would bring a new, young, teenage king to the throne in 1217, who would rule as Håkon IV, and the start of his reign would be contemporary to the first period that Snorri Sturluson was elected as the law speaker in Iceland. Håkon would show an interest in Snorri Sturluson and his work, and this may have just been a means by which to use Snorri Sturluson as a diplomatic ally. Håkon would issue a royal invitation to Snorri, and Snorri would relinquish his title as law speaker of the Althing in Iceland to travel over to Norway to be at the court of King Håkon in the year 1218. Håkon would grant gifts to Snorri in return for his poetry, and may have even coerced Snorri into writing about the history of Norway and Sweden, albeit in a fantastic saga form. The sagas from these periods tend to give us a great mixture of history and fantasy that will often leave the neutral historian reader scratching his head about just how much of what he or she is reading can truly be taken seriously. Although there is no doubt that there is some degree of historicity to these sagas, and they are often sifted through for clues about what happened in the lands of the North Atlantic Ocean. King Haakon's motivation for this may have been to add more credibility to his own rule of Norway by having highly respected historical accounts written by the highly respected Snorri Sturluson. But his real motivation was to increase his international influence, and this would include attempting to befriend the most powerful chieftains in Iceland. If you recall, particular chieftains, which included Snorri Sturluson, were now beginning to monopolise Icelandic wealth, and King Haakon IV of Norway knew that by making political alliances, he would be more successful back home. King Haakon and Snorri Sturluson seemed to have an understanding with each other that they could both benefit from each other. With Haakon's support, Snorri could become among the most wealthy and influential men in Iceland, and Haakon's position as the monarch of Norway could come with the support of Icelandic allies. Snorri would return to Iceland in around the year 1220, with honours bestowed upon him by Haakon, and Haakon would now have a highly influential character close to the Icelandic court.
The Age of the Sturlungs.
So, with a strong relationship with the Norwegian king cemented in place thanks to the popularity of his work and his position of influence in Iceland, let's find out how Snorri's life played out. Snorri was still a highly respected individual in Iceland, and in 1222 he was instated as the law speaker of the Althing for the second time, a position on this occasion that he would hold for around 10 years. During this time, Snorri would continue to be popular among the neutrals for his writing, and he would continue to use diplomacy to climb the social ladder and maintain his wealth. As the primary advocate of a union between Iceland and Norway, he would create enemies with the other major chieftains of Iceland, which forced them into a position of opposing Snorri or seeking their own individual affiliations with King Haakon. Snorri would marry his old mentor's granddaughter. His old mentor is namely Jon Loftsson, who educated Snorri in his younger years. The marriage would have been to solidify his political affiliation with the mighty Oddaverjar family of Iceland, themselves claiming descent from the Norwegian throne through Jon Loftsson himself, a grandson of King Magnus III. Loftsson's granddaughter also came with considerable wealth, which strengthened Snorri's standing. During the latter years of the 1220s, Snorri was probably the most powerful and influential man in Iceland. Some historians suggest that Snorri did not appear to show much in the way of action to support the idea of an alliance between Iceland and Norway, despite this being the Icelandic direction that Snorri was the spearhead for. It is difficult to assess why Snorri would have had this attitude. He may have sensed that his alliance with Haakon was ineffective to his own cause, if indeed King Haakon was actually looking for the devotion of all of Iceland. Maybe we're even trying to read too much into the whole relationship between Haakon and Iceland. We have to consider that Iceland was an island with very little fertility and very precariously set up. Local leaders would have understood that there was very little excess production that would create enough wealth to prepare an army, and even if they were prepared to enter military exchanges with Icelandic rivals, the potential losses to themselves would not have been a joy to entertain. In short, a military battle was just not worth it for anybody. Equally, inactivity and passiveness was also not an option. If a neighbouring chieftain sensed weakness in his neighbour, then it might be worth the risk. And if you believed that your neighbour was preparing for conflict, then you would be foolish for not preparing for this outcome. One of the notable opponents of Snorri was his own brother Sigvatur, who was now ably assisted by his own son Sturla Sigvatsson. Snorri was suitably concerned by the threat of his brother and nephew and would prepare for military conflict, which we realise would be a last resort in the lands of Iceland. This may have only been posturing from Snorri's perspective, probably believing that with King Håkon of Norway on his side, that anybody would be foolish to take him on. It may be the case that Sigvatr took the threat seriously though, and amassed his own force of hundreds to counterbalance Snorri's army, and it was enough to call Snorri's bluff, as Snorri decided not to go through with the conflict. Sigvatr sensed that this was a sign of his younger brother's unwillingness to fight, and that the opportunity existed to attack the spineless Snorri, who fled into refuge elsewhere in Iceland. This conflict would be part of a greater struggle for Iceland. The most prominent Icelandic chieftains would have to decide whether they were for the Norwegian Union with King Håkon or against it. As other chieftains decided to pledge loyalty to King Håkon, it wouldn't be too surprising to consider that Håkon may have seen his personal relationship with Snorri as an increasingly expendable one. So Snorri's lack of desire to engage in military battles was now playing against him because other Icelandic chieftains were willing to fight for what they believed in. It was certainly not unusual for Icelandic warriors to pledge themselves to fight on Norwegian soil during their own civil war for a share of the spoils. So even though we believe that military exchanges within Iceland itself could be damaging for all parties, it wasn't as if Icelanders were battle-shy. Opportunity for great wealth for Icelanders was limited, and so the attraction of an alliance with King Håkon may have been too difficult to resist for those who were setting their sights higher than their current lot. Coupled with this, the fact that your rivals were making the switch and the possibility of being left behind would have been too much to prevent any hesitance. It would actually be a son of Snorri, who is known to us as Ulrika Snorrason, who would lead an army in defence of his father and against the forces of his uncle Sigvatr and his cousin Sturla. So Snorri was safe for now, but Iceland was in turmoil. Despite Snorri's best attempts to re-establish himself as the most powerful man in Iceland, he was successfully exiled to Norway by his brother and his nephew, who would now have to battle against other powerful families in Iceland, such as the Hogdalir family clan, headed by the notable Gissur Þorvaldsson, himself a great-grandson of Jon Lofsson. So it was now Gissur who was posing a threat to Sigvatr, while Snorri was in exile in Norway with King Håkon. Snorri's relationship with Håkon on this occasion was full of distrust now that Snorri's value to Håkon was diminished. In the meantime, back in Iceland, Snorri's brother Sigvatr and his son Sturla were on a collision course with his rival Gissur Þorvaldsson. Gissur had amassed a large force to counterbalance the forces of Sigvatr, and he did this by striking up an anti-Sturlung alliance with a man called Kolbin Ungi Arnason of the Ausbirninga family clan. The two armies would meet on the 21st of August 1238 at the Battle of Ulriksdatter. The outcome was a victory for the alliance, who defeated the Sturlunga, also killing both Sigvatr Sturluson and his son Sturla Sigvatsson. It was after this battle that Snorri would approach King Håkon and request that he be allowed to return to Iceland. But King Håkon, who himself was growing ever distrustful of everyone around him due to the continuing civil war in Norway, denied Snorri passage to Iceland, fearing that he may be about to rally Icelanders against King Håkon, and instead for his political rival and father-in-law, Duke Skúli Bårðsson. Snorri would famously declare the legendary phrase, Ut vil ek, which essentially means, I want to go. Despite Håkon denying Snorri passage, Skúli would arrange it against Håkon's orders. Snorri would return to Iceland and would find himself politically opposed to his former ally, King Håkon. It would appear that it would be at this time that King Håkon approached the victor at the Battle of Ulriksdatter, Gissur Þorvaldsson, and struck up an alliance. Håkon felt that Gissur was the right man to get behind in his quest to bring Iceland under his influence, and he now saw Snorri Sturluson as a threat to that aim. King Håkon was able to defeat and kill his father-in-law, Duke Skúli, which was yet another blow for Snorri, who was now a primary target for King Håkon, who is believed to have sent an instruction to Gissur to either kidnap or kill Snorri. Subsequently, Gissur took a force of men to Snorri's home in Rekhot in 1241 with intentions to capture him. Snorri would not surrender himself to Gissur, which forced Gissur to issue the command to strike Snorri down. After Snorri cried out the words, E skal hugva, a direct protest against being struck down, he would be struck and killed, bringing an end to the life of Snorri Sturluson at the age of 62. Snorri was embroiled in the political affairs of both Iceland and Norway, and it was this that led to his murder. However, Snorri was known to many as the creator of great sagas and poetry, and the loss was felt with great levels of grief throughout the populations of Iceland and Norway. This was the end of Snorri's lifetime, but it wasn't the end of the age of the Sturlungs. Another son of Snorri's brother Sigvatur was a man called Thorod Kakali Sigvatsson, and he would take up the cause of the Sturlunga family clan by battling back against the rival families and catching the attention of King Håkon, who would befriend Thordur and summon him to Norway, where he would actually die before he could return to Iceland. So King Håkon would choose to strengthen his bond with the man who was responsible for Snorri Sturluson's death, Gissur Þorvaldsson. Gissur would be granted the title of Earl of Iceland by King Håkon, and he would be very active in pushing through an agreement that would unify Iceland to Norway, ending Icelandic independence from 1264 up until 1944. This agreement is called the Old Covenant. The Icelanders would now submit taxes to the Norwegian crown in return for legislation and protection. King Håkon IV Håkonsson, the King of Norway, was also known as Håkon the Old. Alongside subjugating Iceland, he would also take control of Greenlandic settlements and come to political agreements with other states, including England and Lübeck. He would also usher in a period of prosperity and advancement in Norwegian arts that would symbolise a more hopeful time than during the Norwegian Civil War. In 1263, he would travel to the islands surrounding Scotland, which were possessions of Norway, to defend them from the Scottish King Alexander III. He would pass away while on the Orkney Islands at the age of 59. Leaving the Norwegian realm much stronger than it was when he came to the throne. Gissur Þorvaldsson remained Earl of Iceland, subject to the Norwegian crown, until his own death in 1268.
Legacy.
Snorri Sturluson's legacy is so much more than just a political story linked to the latter years of the Icelandic Commonwealth. It is a legacy of literature, which has taken on a spiritual existence all of its own. The Viking sagas were mainly the work of Icelanders, despite the Vikings being more consciously associated with Norway and Denmark. Snorri Sturluson is considered as at the forefront of saga writing. Snorri's sagas would give valuable insights into the history of medieval Nordic societies of Scandinavia and the lands closely linked to it. Not only that, but it would give valuable insights into the mythology and religion of Nordic peoples. Even though many of the sagas would have much in the way of fictional activity interspersed with a genuine historical narrative, their influence on future societies is considerable. Trolls and elves find their origin in Norse mythologies and sagas, and they are very much a feature of fantasy fiction right up until the modern age, and this is thanks to the unique storytelling style of such writers as Snorri Sturluson. So the legacy of his work can be felt to this modern day, with little known about the origins of such things as trolls and elves. The Prose Edda is a book of texts that are believed to have been written to a lesser or greater degree by the pen of Snorri Sturluson, and gives great details about the poets and their writing styles, as well as a study on poetic phraseology. There is also a discussion about Norse gods within this Edda too. It may be that a great degree of these works were written during the golden years of Snorri's friendship with King Håkon while he was in Norway for the first time, and this undoubtedly was the time when Snorri gathered much information about the history of the crowns of both Norway and Sweden, which were contained among the texts of the Heimskringla, which he may have written after returning to Iceland as King Håkon's closest Icelandic supporter. The writings of Viking sagas, including the work of Snorri Sturluson, would have undoubtedly conjured up imagination-inspiring stories, including those that influenced the works of modern authors such as George R. R. Martin, who wrote the series of novels called A Song of Ice and Fire, which instigated the great fantasy drama television series Game of Thrones. Also, those fantasy novels written by J.R.R. Tolkien during his lifetime, such as The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, which have also been turned into epic films of great popularity. So the fantasy genre of writing and film is now a huge attraction, and we can owe a lot to the Viking Age sagas and the work of one Snorri Sturluson. A big thank you for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast, a special episode, one outside the boundaries of our usual productions and our usual schedule, which is an episode commissioned by History of the World Illuminati member Shane Smith, who especially asked me to make an episode on that very gentleman, Snorri Sturluson. And if you want to make a pledge for your own episode, you can. You can just go to the Patreon website. If you go to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and click on Patreon, you can sign up to make monthly contributions. And then as soon as you accrue the necessary amount of money to be able to commission your own special episode, simply give me the subject, and if it's reasonable and doable, then I will make you your own episode, exactly the same as today's episode. So I'd like to thank Shane, firstly for his donation, secondly for his suggestion, and thirdly for his patience, because it was a number of months ago that he asked me to do this podcast episode, and he's had to wait a long time very patiently. But I did, firstly, I did want to not interrupt the flow of volume 3, and secondly, I wanted to make sure that this episode was as good as possible, so I did need to make some special efforts to research it. But I hope I did a good job and I hope you enjoyed it, Shane. And likewise to the rest of you, I do also hope that you enjoyed the episode too. It's been a long time since we had a full episode. So I hope that you did appreciate the story. Now, I would also like to welcome and thank new members of the History of the World podcast, Illuminati, people who have signed up to make monthly contributions or have made other financial contributions. So I'd like to welcome Jason Dirks, Ricard H, Drunk Jesus and Alberto Baeza. You're all now inducted into the History of the World podcast Illuminati. Thank you very much and welcome. And your contributions will go to great lengths to making this podcast a better production, enabling me to purchase materials by which I can add to my my stock of research literature. So thank you so much indeed. As ever, let's dive into some listener messages. First one is from Rob, who has put, Chris, I bet you're wondering, well, he's actually put Merle Haggard, are the good times really over, as his email message. And then he's put, Chris, I bet you wonder the relevance of the subject of this email has. That song has a lyric rolling downhill like a snowball headed towards hell. Or, rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. Sorry, I misread that. I really enjoyed volume one of the podcast. I like the organisation, content and the general overview style. I liked it so much, I contributed $10 per month. I've been listening to volume three and to be honest, it's like dental work. You've gone from the general overview format to such a granular that it's like describing the sand on the beach in such detail. I forget you're describing a beach. Also, you seem more focus on the military aspects of history rather than the general history. Finally, you continue rambling after the content is done. If I wanted to read the reviews, I would log in to read them. Maybe this is what your other listeners want, but as for me, I will move on to something else. Let me know if you go back to your original format, Rob. Well, firstly, Rob, I'm sorry to see you go. Thank you for taking the time to write an email. It's not everyone that would stop listening that would actually write an email. And I'm sorry that volume three appears to be so much different to volume one. I can only imagine that it's mainly because volume one is more about prehistory and therefore there's so much supposition that you can like sort of it's probably brain food, really. But volume three, much more of a storytelling volume, and it will continue to be that way. So I don't imagine that the format is going to change back to volume one, really, if I've read the situation correctly. But just because modern history is really just not the same kind of story, unfortunately. But anyway, and then another thing, I mean, you're not the first person to have said that you're not quite as excited about this part of the podcast as everyone else. I mean, look, I always put it on the end of the podcast, I suppose, so that you've got the choice of whether to keep listening or not. And I think, you know, maybe about three quarters of the people that listen to the podcast right up until the end do listen to this and the other quarter don't. So it's really a personal choice. And all I want to do is add a bit of congratulations and praise to those people who have bothered to write in. I think it's an effort that you've written in. I think you've made that effort, and I think I should in some way acknowledge it. And I think it's really other podcasts that I've listened to that I think, well, you know, that's quite a nice touch. So that's partly why I do it. But thanks for writing in, Rob. I like to read out every message, whether it be good praise or whether it be criticism. So I hope I haven't let the listeners down by reading that out. Fred Gerloff has written, I'm in volume one and I've listened to the first 17 podcasts. I'm absolutely hooked and can't wait to progress through the series. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much, Fred. Very kind message. Phoenix 21899. Sophie. has written in saying, "Dear Chris, I am writing to let you know how much I enjoy your podcast on the history of the world. They are very detailed and informative, and I really appreciate the amount of time and effort you take into making these very interesting podcasts for us all. I am planning to listen to each and every single one of them." God bless you, Sophie. Thank you. That's it. That's it for the emails. Let's cross over to Facebook and Instagram and see what people have been saying there. Well, firstly, I'm going to say thank you to Ellen Greenspan, who I didn't acknowledge last week, had written in and said, because one of our listeners, Paul Mellon, had struggled to listen to one of our episodes. I did throw it out there a couple of weeks ago and ask everyone if there was any way that they could investigate themselves whether they were having the same problem with one of our episodes. I'm pleased to announce that Paul has managed to sort it out so that he can continue to enjoy the podcast. And also thanks to everyone that has written in, including yourself, Ellen. So that's very kind of you to have investigated and seen if you could identify what the problem was. And I'm glad that everything's back to normal for everyone now. So thank you. Jeffrey West has written in saying, "Hi, Chris, I came across your podcast by accident and I love it. I listen while I'm on my exercise walks and am just finishing volume one. I look forward to the next volumes eagerly. A great big picture summary told logically, but in an enjoyable conversational manner. Thank you." Well, thank you for the message, Jeff. And Roger A. Paulson has written in saying, "Hi there, I've just recently discovered your podcast and I'm enjoying it very much. I'm from Cape Town, South Africa." And thank you so much, Roger. That's great to get a message from South Africa. We sort of don't get too many, I don't think. South Africa featured heavily in Volume 1, didn't it, when we were speaking about the pre-Homo sapiens fossils found there, and certainly also the discoveries of artifacts in the caves there that have dated to almost 100,000 years ago. So very, very interesting part of the world, South Africa, for its prehistory. Reviews now. I'm always scared I'm going to find a bad review when I log in here. So it's Liz Bree from the United States of America. "But love this podcast. Thank you so much for providing such an accessible source of historical knowledge that is both fun to listen to and accurately aligned with the current state of scientific knowledge." And our Rory V from Great Britain has put, "Superb. What a fantastic podcast. This is so informative, so well researched, so perfectly condensed and so enjoyable. Thank you so much. I am only on the first series, plus some dabbling into later episodes. Particularly enjoyed the early human and our related cousins episodes. An extremely accomplished and entertaining listen. Highly recommended. Thanks again." Well, you're all ever so kind, aren't you? You always say great things. It's a real good community. We've got a very warm-hearted, kind people who take the time to say kind words about a project that they're enjoying, which not everyone can bring themselves to do that. So give yourselves a big pat on the back and a huge thank you from me also. Next week on the History of the World podcast, we will be making another special episode, and this time is for a very, very good friend of the History of the World podcast, and his name is Nick Barksdale, and a lot of you may know him already as the creator of the YouTube channel The Study of Antiquity and the Middle Ages. Now, I'm sad to say that Nick has been extremely ill this year, and he's recovering from his illness, so if you are familiar with Nick, if you do know who he is, then please do send over some messages of goodwill to him. And we hope to see him back where he belongs, recording, writing, interviewing about history, the subject that we all love. And so it will be my pleasure next week to provide the episode for Nick on the Mississippian culture of pre-Columbian America, and especially the United States of America. So a country where most of you listen from, but we don't talk about very much, do we? We haven't devoted a lot of time to that area of the world during the history of this podcast. And so next week we get that opportunity to talk more about the lands of the USA. So until that time, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this long-awaited special episode. And until next week, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.